listening to Making Good. I'm Renee Blanchard, founder and operator of Church Alley Cafe and Grocery, located here in New Orleans, Louisiana. Church Alley is a people-first, mission-driven small business that I opened in 2013. And the best part about owning a cafe is the people. So in this podcast, I interview the makers, the farmers, and the many interesting people I've met through the shops. The folks doing the good work here in Louisiana and all along the Gulf Coast. Let's get started.
I am Ruthie Winston. I'm a native New Orleanian, although I've spent some time out of the city, which makes me appreciate it probably more. I am a licensed certified appraiser, although I guess I'm not licensed. I'm certified appraiser of personal property, which means I am, according to the International Society of Appraisers and the Appraisal Foundation, I'm qualified to list what is in your home for different reasons, whether it's for insurance or because you want to give it to your favorite child or somebody has passed on or you're divorcing. So my partner and I at Winston Associates, located down here in the beautiful Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities Building, we write documents to help people sort through what to do with or how to take care of their things. I'm also a licensed professional auctioneer and have been since 1990 here in New Orleans, selling for some of the estate auction houses here, as well as doing a fair amount of charity work. So that's my elevator ride.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to talk with you. Ella, our mutual friend. I was asking her who she thought I should interview. She's like, you have to talk to Ruthie. So how did you first get involved in appraising? Like, I would feel like someone that's doing your work was like maybe fascinated by furniture or antiques or homes or things mm-hmm. like that.
I think as it is with anything, if you love something, you're going to enjoy it and you're going to do it possibly better because you care about it. But I actually resisted the appraisal end of my business, which is antiques, fine art, estate, property, because I just had this preconceived idea that I had to be about 75 years old, which I'm approaching, but I had to be about 75 years old and, you know, only wear black and pearls. And, you know, after all my years, I have all this experience. And then I finally realized that no one is supposed to know it all, and that it's really the methodology of learning about something and presenting an argument as to why something may be of a certain value within the specified context. So if you ask me how much this chair is quote unquote worth because you lost it in a fire, that's a different number than if you might want to sell it. So it's coming to terms with the fact that depending upon the use of the number, it's a different value. But I got into it because my father is a collector and I spent a lot of time standing around antique shops and I have a love of things and an appreciation for things and their history.
That's cool. And so your father collected antiques or specific thing or specific items or what was...
There was a, you know, progression through different categories. You know, everyone collects something, I would think. It's a human trait, unless you're so highly evolved that you really are happy to just take inspiration from within. There's a need to, you know, collect and understand something. So, and an appreciation for beauty, an appreciation for history. And then there are obviously people who go after or about collecting things because they also understand that the art industry and antiques industry, not so much the antiques, but the art, fine art industry is a multi-billion dollar business. And so they may not actually love the object, but they're hoping to make some money on the object.
Right. Yeah. And what is the definition of an antique? Like, is there a time period?
It's always been a stumbling block. People are like, well, if an antique is 100 years old, does that mean like on January 2nd, it's already?
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, I would answer that in a sort of convoluted way by saying an antique doesn't necessarily make it valuable. Mm. The word antique is meant to convey age. So is it 17th, 18th, 19th century? Is it prehistoric? Is it? And then the other thing I've learned as an auctioneer and as an appraiser is it doesn't matter if it's an antique or not for it to bring money. Mm-hmm. Something that is quote unquote of the late 20th century if it is good looking and is trendy, it can bring more money than an antique. So the antique word is a bit difficult, but it is supposed to be theoretically 100 plus years.
Oh,
it's
okay.
It's better to say that something is of the 19th century, late 19th century, mid 19th century, early first quarter, something like that. You know, you don't want to go into an antique shop and buy a chair that you love, and the person selling it tells you that it's an early 19th century chair, and then 2 or 3 years later you have an issue with it. Somebody broke a leg and you get it restored and you have it appraised, and they say, well, actually this is a 1950s example of a 19th century chair, but you paid the 19th century price.
Right. So that's interesting. So do you, so you go into people's homes, like for estate sales or things like that as well. And then if people have items that they were given from family members or friends to kind of appraise what they have and understand, do you also, like if someone is like, oh, wants to buy something from someone's house, you would then go with them to look at the item?
Possibly, but that doesn't happen that often. We might get a phone call that says, so-and-so has decided to let go of their grandmother's candelabra, and she doesn't know what to price them, and I don't know what to offer them. Can you come see them or take a look at a photograph of them and give us an idea of fair market value, mm-hmm. Or whatever the value they're striving to get? So we go in houses by the invitation of the owner or the executor or executrix for specific reasons. Like after Ida, we might have been called in because they were in the process of an insurance claim. Mm-hmm. If you're divorcing, they want to divide the property. If someone has died and it's a taxable estate, they are compelled to have the personal property listed and report it to the government. Mm-hmm. If it is below the taxable estate number, then they may want us to do what we call a restricted appraisal, which is a leaner version of the document and allows the family members to equitably divide. So property is itemized by room and illustrated and described. And then the family members who may not even live here and maybe haven't seen the property in a long time can go about picking what they want, being informed of what it is and what the value at the time of death was.
Yeah.
So. But anyway, what about getting into a house is, and what keeps it so interesting is so many times through the mythology of a family, they're told, oh, you know, Great Aunt Minnie's Bays, you know, it's a second coming. When in fact, so then they hire the appraiser or an auction house to come in. They're like, you know, I need a hip replacement. It's $5,000. So this vase must be worth $5,000. And you go to look at the vase, but in fact, it's the table that the vase is on that is worth all the money. And they had no idea.
So interesting. Yeah. I mean, I know, like, just as a little kid, we had, my grandparents had like a Picasso, you know, very nicely framed, not a real Picasso in any way, but I absolutely believe, we all believed it really was, you know,
right. Picasso. You just wanted it to be, right?
Yeah, I think so. And we all still laugh. I do have it in my, it was something I wanted to bring when my grandmother had passed. No one else wanted it. They're like, that's not real. I was like, I love that we just imagined our whole lives that this was like this real thing.
Yeah, it's part of the tapestry of your family.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's great.
Yeah, it really was.
There is usually one or two objects like that. And it's not about them being valuable. It's about the relationship the family had with that object. I remember walking into the Pontalba Apartments once, one apartment, and I gravitated to this duck tureen. So it looked like a duck sitting on a nest.
Uh-huh.
It was probably faience of some type. And every single one of the family members just started looking at me and looking at each other. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, you know. And they're like, how did you know? And I said, how did I know what? And they're like, every time our grandmother left the apartment, she would leave a love note inside the duck tureen for someone.
Aww.
And you just went straight to it.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, some things have energy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Like your Picasso.
I know. I loved it. I was so curious about, because you had said that you're certified and not licensed for appraisal. What does that mean? So like if someone was looking, usually licensing or certification is something to protect customers or the people that are buying something or patients. Yeah. Or something like that.
It's a semantic. I wanted to be careful because in just talking sometimes just run on. I want to be careful because I'm proud to be a member of the International Society of Appraisers, who have an even higher writing standard than the Appraisal Foundation. So the quick People magazine version is, before 1989, the appraisers of the world appraising personal property were not very well regulated. In fact, I think the quotation was, the barbers of the United States of America had more rules and regulations than the appraisers. Mm. It is unethical for us to charge a percentage of the contents or of an item. So in 1989, the federal government stepped in and started creating the Appraisal Foundation and something that guides us all still and we must test for regularly, which is the Uniform Standards of Appraisal Practice, USPAP. So I am certified by the International Society of Appraisers, one of three organizations for appraisers in America. The ISA specializes for people who look at personal property, which are the things in your house. The other two organizations, the ASA and the AAA, the ASA is more heavily real estate appraising, and the AAA is more heavily fine art out of New York. Can they all do personal property? Absolutely. But does ISA educate their appraisers for personal property? Absolutely, as well as fine art. So what is a certification as opposed to just being a member? It just means that I have passed a certain level of tests and spent enough hours and have gained a certification by their standards in appraising. And my designations are antiques and residential contents and fine art. My business partner, John, has a designation in fine art, and he is an accredited member. He didn't choose to take it to the next level. But we both worked combined for close to 35 years in estate auction houses. So yeah. We have a wealth of knowledge about a lot of things. We are generalists. We've seen, you know, if you're working in an auction house and they're selling 1,500 lots, give or take, every other month, you're seeing a lot of property.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting.
Anyway, there isn't a license. It's not like I have a little badge that says I am a licensed auctioneer and I have my auction Louisiana auction license number. I do not have a little badge to be a certified appraiser. I am a certified appraiser, but I'm not necessarily licensed. Right. They don't hand me a license.
Right.
So it's a semantic thing.
Are there a lot of certified appraisers here in New Orleans?
Oh, great question. Not only are there not a lot in New Orleans, I think there's two of us here in New Orleans.
Oh, whoa.
When you think about how many lawyers are in the world.
So many.
Think about. I think, and I could have this number wrong, but the ratio speaks to the difference. Thinking about how many lawyers there are in the United States, I think the last time I was given this information, there may only be about 1,000 certified appraisers in the continental United States.
Oh, wow.
Think about the tsunami of the aged. The people 70 and above who are passing some of the largest amounts of wealth in the next 20 years. Mm-hmm. Think about the fact that those are taxable estates. Think about the fact that how many storage units do you see as you drive around the country? People have stuff. So whether it's $1 million item or a $10 item, the relationship people have with their stuff and the psychology connected to that stuff is the same. They care that Picasso that's not right is got some value, and they want to know what it is, and they want to know how to take care of it. So that's what appraisers do.
Yeah, that's so interesting because there's so many. I mean, I guess that it's similar in other cities around the country. It's like, but people, you just go to estate sales like every weekend, you know, or like.
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of stuff out there. Right.
I always just assumed that there was like, I don't know. I mean, I guess I think of like a yard sale is different than an estate sale, you know, that they're going to have more appraised items or there's going to be a reason for the amount and all of those kind of things.
I think the estate word is the $100 word and the yard sale is the $10 word.
Yeah.
I think unless you have someone who says my so-and-so died, making it an estate, then it's not an estate sale.
Yeah.
You're just, otherwise it's a garage sale or a tag sale or a moving sale or a downsizing sale. I don't think, you know, the hope is that if it's an estate sale, that the person lived a long life and you may be getting into a wonderful treasure trove of,
yeah,
of some antiques, but you can't assume that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I did a little research and I found this NOLA.com article that you were interviewed for a while ago. And I love how you talked about how people can reimagine their antique pieces, that maybe that it's not really just a choice when you get to the, when someone calls you, it's not really a choice of like selling an item or throwing it away because it's not worth anything. That sometimes these pieces are just built really, really well. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to kind of just paint them over and redo the handles and something like that and reimagine them for your space. Sometimes it feels taboo to like paint over your grandparents.
And it may be. And so that's why it is fairly important to call someone if you think you've got a treasure before you decide to make it pink or white. Mm-hmm. Just email a picture or call someone or show an auction house to make sure you're not taking a rare American piece of furniture and ruining it.
Yeah.
Or any kind of furniture. I mean, true story. I guess it was back in sometime in the 90s. There was a retirement home here and they were redecorating. And so I was invited in because my father was on the board to go take a look and see how I might, through the auction company I represented, help them. And in the sitting room, there was a sofa and it had the same gree-gree going on that duck terrine had going on. Mm-hmm. Now this sofa was in this electric aqua, lime green, white and black, like flame retardant chintz, and it had been painted white, but I knew it to be an American classical sofa. I had no idea how great of an American classical sofa it was, but I knew enough that even though the elderly inhabitants were very upset that I wanted to take this to sell it because it was quote unquote the easiest thing for them to get in and out of because of its height, it subsequently did come to the auction house. And then several months later, after a conservator took a razor knife, the razor knife, like the size of a demitasse spoon, and flicked the white paint off of it, that we then brought it to auction, having determined that it was one of a pair that had belonged to President James Monroe and was living in the White House. It's now part of one of the preeminent American furniture collections.
Oh, wow.
So be careful before you paint anything white.
Yeah.
But what I meant, I think I remember that interview, and I think part of the other part of reinventing antiques is, and as important as it is to try to go green now to save the planet, yeah. Some of these things, if not all of these things, are better made than what you buy. You know, it's wonderful if you're able to go into Restoration Hardware and buy great looking, sleek, sexy things, but there is absolutely no secondary market for it.
Right. That's
so solid wood, you know, the furniture that's showing up at auction is made better and has more integrity. The component I was driving at is, so say you don't really want a marble top mirror back sideboard. You just would never have a dining room anymore. You know, you need an office before you need a dining room, right? Now everybody has these big kitchens. But the marble top mirror back sideboard of whatever period, whether it's late 19th century, French, American, English, can now be a great bar.
Mm-hmm.
It's a marble top cabinet where you can store everything. You can take a server and make it the perfect height for a changing table for a child. So there's things that you can, the intended use of the object back in the 19th century can be reinvented for 20th century use.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's some beautiful, I have a lot of just chairs, and I have, my grandfather had these recliners that are from the 50s and they are woven fabric. And it's really interesting. And they're like that green, that, you know, not a bright green, but it's like not a hunter green either. That was really popular. And then they recline by moving the back through notches. Like you
it's
just
a Morris chair. Yeah.
Yeah, you lift the notches. And they're really neat. And so you can sit at different angles. But yeah. It's a wooden. I remember being a little kid in the attic. They were in the attic and I would sit on them and I was like, okay, well, I love that they're so comfortable. But yeah, they're just in my living room. You know, they're not in some fancier or dining room.
Things are made to be loved and used. Absolutely. Yeah.
And you also were talking about how you're an auctioneer as well.
Yes. After I graduated with a history major, I ended up working in New York City for Doyle Gallery at the time, William Doyle Gallery, now Doyle. And then when I moved home here, I worked for several auction houses. And after, you know, what happened was after you do lots of different jobs, at least for me, for an auction, whether you're helping with customer service or whatever you're doing to help make the auction happen, it was just a natural progression for me that it was like, at some point it was like, well, that's the one job I haven't done.
Oh,
and
yeah.
At the time my boss encouraged me to do it. And so I gave it a try and I've been doing it ever since.
So it's, do you have to practice to do it? What was the very first time you got up to do an auction? Like,
I hate to tell you, the very first time I got up to do it, you know, that little airline vodka that you have?
Yes.
I brought that up to the auction stand just thinking if it gets really bad, I'm going to take it. Here I am in New Orleans, you know?
Yeah.
But what happened was my first time, the thing I hated the most about it, the thing that terrified me the most about it was I didn't like hearing my voice on the microphone. It was startling to me. You don't normally think of hearing yourself. And so the resonance and the loudness of it frightened me. I was like, ugh, like my brain wandered over to that. And then what happened in the first time that I was in the gallery to sell, and I was clipping along, you know, 250, 275, 3, you know, trying to find my rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
One of the regular auction goers, a dealer, this wonderful old man from Bunky, Louisiana, just been in the business forever, and actually a really kind-hearted man, he took issue with something I did. I guess I missed this, whatever I did, and he challenged me. Mm. And it was a saving grace because he got my blood up and he got me mad. And I said, I am the auctioneer and acknowledging so-and-so. And it shifted something in me. But it took me years and years and years to not get nervous to get up there. But once you get up there, it is truly a zone.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of fun. It's fun to see. It's fun to... There's lots of things that are happening. You see who's in front of you. The auctions are not as well attended as they used to be because there's so many portals that people can participate in, whether it's, you know, online or phone, or it used to be standing room only.
Yeah.
But what I'm getting to is, you know, 20 or 30, 40, 50, 100 lots into the sale, you kind of get a sense of the people who are there, what they like, you know, what they're bidding on. And so when something comes up and you're thinking, oh, well, that will kind of fit with what they like, you kind of stare at them to wait and see if they're going to bid. And sure enough.
Really?
It's human nature. It's fun to watch.
Yeah. And so how, like, what was, when you're like, okay, yes, I'm going to do this auction. I'm going to do it. Fine. You know, like that first time, what did you do to prepare for it? What were you thinking about?
Well, in the state of Louisiana back then, you could either apprentice under your boss, who was the auctioneer, or apprentice under an auctioneer in the auction house where you worked, meaning they would theoretically train you and take responsibility for whatever it is you were doing and stand there next to you.
Oh, okay.
That to me required time and patience, two things I'm not real good with. So I went to the High Point Auctioneering School in High Point, North Carolina, which is a 2.5-week course back then. And I was one of three women in the course. The rest of them, other 75 people, were men, and they were there for cattle. They were there for cars. But essentially, they formulated, I think there were at that time two auction schools, one in Missouri and one there in North Carolina. And I picked that one, geography, you know, winning out. Mm-hmm. And they taught you to chant. The curriculum was more or less if you were going to start your own auction company. So they brought you through how to do that. But what it gave me and what I needed for the state of Louisiana was a piece of paper that said I graduated from the High Point Auctioneering School, and then I had to go to the state and take a test.
Okay.
And then I had to chant in front of them, and then they decided whether I could be an auctioneer or not. And then every year after that, you pay your fee, and you used to have to do CE, but you no longer have to. But every state is different. There's different rules in every state as to, and I can't go sell a sale. I can't sell for anybody in Mississippi without getting a Mississippi state license. There's no reciprocity. I have a Louisiana auctioneer's license.
Oh, interesting.
And all the states are different.
So you had to, in your test, you had to like mock auctioneer in front of people?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That is wild. And it's called a chant, you were saying.
It is a chant. And as they explained in school, I mean, this is going back to 1990, so I'm trying to, every auctioneer has a different style. And if you're selling cattle or if you're selling, you know, if you're shutting down a Walmart, you're doing a whole different thing as opposed to selling an important, you know, bronze that's estimated 300,000 to 500,000. Mm-hmm. So what you're selling and the environment in which you're selling dictates a different, shall we say, cadence and style. So an auctioneer who's selling livestock or cars sells in a different way than an estate antiques, you know, auctioneer does. But yeah, and you develop your own style. Everybody has their own style. So
wow, that's so interesting. So what is the reasoning to that your auctioneer license doesn't transfer to another state?
Money.
Money, yeah. Okay.
They want their fees, they have their rules. I mean, I don't know that emphatically, but that's my guess.
Sure. Yeah.
And also, you know, it used to be the history of auction, as I recall it, is in the not so distant past. And if you see Ukraine, you know, in the current times, auctioneers were called colonels. And part of that, I believe the mythology of it or the actual history of it is that when the marauding forces would come through and conquer a town, they would hold an auction afterwards to get rid of the personal property or seize things if they didn't just take them. And I could be wrong there, but I do kind of remember that.
Oh,
so for many, many years, auction was thought of as a fire sale. It was a bad thing to have. You know, oh, you know, the little family down the road is in bankruptcy and they're going to auction off the farm. You know, that's a sad, bad thing.
Yeah.
And then there was a shift. And auction became understood to be a dynamic marketplace where why trust the dealer offering you X or the private person offering you X? Why not put it out? And then the internet came along and boom, the whole thing changed. The world sees if you're, depending upon your search engine here, you know, if you have this vase that was your Picasso, that was your grandmother's, and you want to sell it, then wouldn't it be smart to put it into an international internet-based sale where who knows might notice it?
Right. Yeah. That's interesting. Ella said that she always tells us when y'all are doing auctions on the weekends, and she said it's just a really interesting and fun day, you know, that the whole, that it's all, yeah, that there's a lot going on and people are coming in and out, but that, and yeah, you were saying that people can be on the phone, like you have people on the phone.
Well, the beauty of auction is, and it really is it's a family sport if you want it to be, and it can be a huge learning curve for people. Mm-hmm. So say there's anywhere from 800 to 1200 lots on the floor, and it's everything from sterling flatware, silver pieces, to rugs, to furniture, to paintings, to chandeliers, a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you can touch it, sit on it, feel it, unless for some reason the object is fragile and the auction house asks you not to, but it's an experiential learn. It's not like you're in a museum where you can't touch it.
Oh,
you can go self-educate. You can go measure it to make sure it's going to fit in your house. In fact, one of the first rules of auction is buyer beware. If you come back to the auction to buy it, it is understood and announced again that you have inspected it and you are accepting the condition that it is in. So say something's estimated $300 to $500, it's going to open at about $150, and there's a chance that it may only sell for $150.
Mm-hmm.
So it's It's a great way to learn about different things, and it's a great way to, you know, depending upon the husband and wife or your friends, it's, you know, somebody might be looking for something particular for their house. And we actually had a couple, maybe a year and a half ago, where I sell right now, who came in and had never been to an auction before. They previewed, they had just bought a house. And at the end of the 2-day sale, they came up to the counter and they were just giddy. They were like, I cannot believe this. We just furnished our house for less than we were going to furnish one room.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And they got great stuff.
Yeah. I have to admit, like, I really thought the movies were correct on how an auction works, and you get like a pamphlet and that's what you're looking at. And, you know, I didn't realize that y'all have everything out and you can go and look at everything and measure it and like touch it and see every piece of it. Well, that's so interesting. I think that, is there anything, is there another experience? I mean, you've given some examples here, but is there any other experience that really stands out for you in your appraisal, in your appraising experience?
I think, first of all, the thing to remember is no one does know it all. And an appraiser is first and foremost providing an objective opinion of value. I'm not representing an auction company trying to get a consignment. I'm not a dealer trying to buy something from you. Mm-hmm. We're there to hopefully figure out what these things are so that the family or the individual can decide what to do with them, if anything. Mm-hmm. So there are times where we found some fun things. I mean, being a history major, it's always fun for me to sort of, you can find a silver vase or urn that may have an inscription on it. And it, in just reading the inscription and then doing a bit of research, you may find, as we did one time, that this had been the gift to a civic leader back in Meridian, Mississippi, who had done such and such and such and such. There's little bits of human interest and stories connected to lots of the property.
Yeah.
So that's sort of fun. Although I have to say, one of my favorite objects I ever handled, which I don't think it may have been sold, but this goes way back to when I first moved back from New York. An attic in St. Francisville was emptied, and all of these papers were moved into the auction house for us to determine, you know, what they were and where they were going to go. And they were the communications between these two families in the late 1790s into the early part of the 19th century. And one of the things that was in this trove of scrolled papers was a little, like, 3x5 kid skin book. Mm-hmm. And it was not completely filled in, but the beginning of it, and the only bit of it, was a diary. And my memory is fairly tight on it. It was the diary of a revolutionary officer, I believe, who had decided to go AWOL and go up into Canada and trap the beaver for the fur or whatever he was doing. I mean, it was this whole like made for TV movie thing. So
that's amazing. That's so interesting. Yeah. I'm reading this book right now, and it's nonfiction. It's just about food in the South, like the history of like how the meal time kind of developed in the South. Hmm. It obviously talks a lot about like race and food and whiteness and what was happening during the Civil War, and a lot of it is based on letters between wives throughout the South and sisters and like and what they were serving and what they were dressing like and who was in their home, who lived there, who visited. It was just so fascinating, and it's very similar to what you're explaining, is that this author found these letters through just either someone had a box of stuff that, you know, or these old homes, and they just found something, or in libraries letters were given or passed down, but it really
often, you know, just you happen to share that you liked a particular thing in your family's home, mm-hmm. but not every generation has someone who has an appreciation for those things. And as the world has gotten so fast and people are not just taking a job, one or two, three, four jobs in and of the same region or town, they're taking jobs all over the world. And they're not necessarily going to be schlepping things with them when they move to Dubai. And there is a large or vast group of people who would prefer to have the next phone or the next car. Yeah. And so, you know, personal property can be a bit of a burden. You know, you have to be willing to take care of it. Mm-hmm. And you also have to want to have that connection with the past. So there's, in every generation, there may be one, for lack of a better word, historian or family person. So, you know, I did a job years and years ago, and it turned out, you know, she had, I think, five children, but she was an only child, and her mother had been an only child. And the long and the short of it is, from what the children related to me, when their mother inherited all of this from her mother, she just shoved it in the attic and didn't even look at it. Mm-hmm. So by the time she was in a place where they had to empty her house, it was finally coming to light. So how long had it sat there with nobody looking at it? You know, at least 80 years.
Right.
So things survive that way.
Yeah. That's such a good point that we are moving, you know, people live in different cities a lot now. And though Louisiana probably has one of the lower end of like people leaving and traveling and living in other places, but we don't really carry any of those boxes, or we're not going to. Moving is horrible.
Right. I remember I was flying to New York to start the job that I had been accepted to do at Doyle. And I was thinking to myself, how is this going to work? I was from an environment, a culture, and a family that didn't let go of anything. Mm-hmm. And I was like, how are they ever going to get enough stuff? And apparently that's not a problem in the Northeast. Oh, it's not a problem here anymore either. There's plenty of stuff going around. But having been brought up here, that was my thought, was, wow, I'm actually going to go work in a state auction house, which is what I wanted to do. But, you know, where's this stuff coming from? From everybody I know, you know, this has been in the family for 300 years, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's interesting. There's something about opening a box of like photos that you haven't seen since you were a little kid or something like that, you know, and rediscovering pictures of your great grandparents or their siblings and who you look like or who you don't look like, or, you know, I take a lot of pictures on my phone because I do want to document stuff, but then it's like, well, where are these pictures?
Are you gonna put them? Right. I will say that is a very rewarding, or I personally found it very rewarding in what I do, having worked for auction houses and as an appraiser, is when I do have the good fortune to see a piece of history that connects to either a particular family, when it's not a breach of trust, and or a piece of Louisiana history, it is very gratifying to try to make sure that the institutions that are protecting our history are informed about it and are given an opportunity, either because it's guided to auction or you're connecting people, to get it saved.
Yeah.
So because I remember one house that we emptied, in the little horrible little Vernis Martin, you know, pardon me, I'm just not a big, you know, painty glitzy thing, but in a little curio cabinet, there was a scroll along with all the little dust collectory things, you know, this porcelains and everything. But there was a scroll and it had a wonderful red seal on it. And I carefully unfurled it and it was signed by Governor Villery.
Oh, wow.
And it had to do the conversation and it had to do with, you know, I'm going to dispatch so-and-so up to the such-and-such because they're having trouble with Indians up there and we need to be able to protect the such-and-such. And I'm like, holy cow.
Yeah.
And that did suddenly sell to a Villery family member who bought it at auction.
Oh, wow. And I have heard recently a lot of these, or that the universities take full libraries of people's from people's homes, or, you know, of people, mm-hmm. or scholars or writers or something like that. They'll just take their entire office, everything that's included, like everything that's in their desk or
anything
like that. And so some of the stuff that our family members, we may not even know exists, like Tulane could have letters of all kinds of stuff. And I guess they archive all of those types of things.
Well, that's the other great thing about the web is that, you know, asking and re-asking the question and clicking along, you may be able to piece together quite a bit because there are places like that. And then New Orleans is incredibly blessed to have the Historic New Orleans Collection, whose primary function being the preservation of our culture.
Yeah, I have a double here in Central City, and I have looked at, I really appreciate the that collection because they have examples of home floor plans.
They are a phenomenal resource.
Yeah, and it's so interesting just to think about like the weather or the time period of why that type of floor plan was needed and to be able to like look through all these images. It's just fascinating.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah. I guess I really only have like one other question for you. And I kind of asked this to a lot of people is, you know, what do you think is your best failure?
I learned the hard way more than once that, and this has to do with the business of the business.
Yeah.
That, first and foremost, as Bill Doyle told me when I first started in the business, every object is actually connected to a psychological reason. Mm-hmm. Either you need to sell it or it's a sad situation, whatever it is. So having some empathy and trying to treat people well is important. But the point I'm trying to get to is so you can be... It's very important to foster a relationship with the client and talk to them so that you understand what they need and that you give them what they need. Let's get real clear on why you asked me here. You invited me in because you said you wanted to know what this was worth. Do you want to know what it's worth because you want to sell it or because you want to insure it? You know, let's get real clear. Mm-hmm. So you have these conversations, which we did. So here's the biggest regret, which I learned from. We had a conversation with the client. We thought we're very clear that she had invited us in to look at fine art. And so we're going to do a fine art appraisal for her. In the course of this bonding conversation, she's like, oh my God, you all can do the silver and the furniture and everything else? I said, yes, ma'am. We can do the contents for you. We did not at that time in our business have a contract or a letter of engagement. Mm-hmm. And so we did the whole job. It took us a long time. And we presented the bill. And she refused to pay it because we had discussed a fee for just the fine art. So I made the assumption that she, of course, understood that, yes, even though we could do everything else, it wasn't for the same price as the fine art. So we now, no matter whether you're related to me or my business partner or whether you're our best friends, I would say 98.5% of the time, we are going to write you a letter of engagement that confirms why you asked us to do it, that you asked us to do it. We're going to define the value we're going to use. We're going to tell you how much we charge. We're going to give you a range of time it's going to take to do the job because we charge by the hour. And we're going to ask you to sign that.
Wow. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a big lesson.
Yes, it was. And it was. And so lesson learned.
Yeah, I love those things when you're first starting out because, you know, so my shop, I've been open 10 years this year.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. And this is my third location and I've been in this location for almost 6 years. But the first 4 years I had two locations because of bad landlords and no lease, you know, not having a lease
right.
For the first year and all these things.
I can't believe people are going to behave badly and then they do.
No, right. Yeah, exactly. You know, and I think about those first 4 years were so hard because every single thing went wrong. But I tell you what, I can imagine, like I can go through scenarios because it's more than likely happened to me, you know, of right. Like why I need this written into a lease or like whatever it is, you know.
Right.
They're so important, but yeah, they're seared into our memories when they happen.
Well, it's just like, you know, when you get a flat tire, you drive more carefully.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's, you know, when we, as my business partner likes to say, you pay the tuition.
Yeah. Right.
Something happens, you pay the tuition, you make the adjustment, and it as a rule doesn't happen again, because, you know, now you're aware of what could go wrong.
Yeah. And then you make new mistakes.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, building the trust and establishing the trust in the beginning is very, very important. Because let's face it, people are letting us into their homes to look at what they have. And you're providing a service that at times hits them, or they need the service at one of their worst moments. Their beloved has died, or they're raw from a divorce, or, you know, they've had Ida rip their roof off and everything is ruined. So you have to, you should be sensitive to all of that and try to provide the service they need and not broadside them with a bill that they're not expecting.
Right. And respect that, respect their story, that, you know, of what right. happened, of how they got there, how they got into that situation.
Yeah. And just because something, we walk into all spectrums of property. And what I think is very important to realize is that it's not necessarily the value of it. It's the relationship the person has to it. So they may be very, very proud of their $20 pottery vase, and it's very valuable to them because their grandmother gave it to them. And so the same thought and due diligence goes into informing them about it as it does on a $20,000 vase.
Right. Yeah, that's really beautiful.
You know, they should not be, you don't dismiss someone simply because the contents of their home is $5,000 and the contents of somebody else's home is $5
million. Right. It has meaningful stories nonetheless.
Well, and yes, exactly. And value to them.
Yeah.
So it's every day is different. I learn something every day, and it has been a very gratifying. I'm sorry I didn't take my father's advice in 1987 and start doing it then, but I just couldn't imagine a 27-year-old girl knowing enough to do it. But
yeah,
I, you know, a contractor doesn't build a house; he hires other subspecialists. And so, when I finally got that through my head, I realized it's really about orchestrating the best possible people to answer the questions that I'm not equipped to answer, and then making an argument for why the things have the value we've determined.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Okay. So how can people, your business is open to the public, right? Like, people can call y'all. So how
can they call us, but we're in the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities building. It's a locked office. So we okay. are not in the retail business.
Right.
We are in the document producing business. We will also consult, so that if the family calls and says, we have about 10 things left, we need you to appraise them, and when you go over to their home and they realize, no, they don't really want it appraised, they want it sold, then we put on a consultant's hat and we help guide them to the best market for that property.
Okay.
They don't need a written document. They don't need to pay for one. Okay. So they can call us. We have our website. Make an appointment. We're happy to come to you. They can email us pictures. They can mail us pictures. Based on the conversation, it may be that we refer them to an auction house straight up and just say, you don't need to pay us for an opinion of value if you really just want to sell it based on what you said you have in the photograph you sent us. We think this person will help you the best.
Okay.
So.
Great.
Well, we're trying to be a resource.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much, Ruthie. That was so interesting.
Thank you, Renee. It was nice to see you, and I wish you well. Congratulations on your 10 years.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks.
And I'll make sure I thank Ella.
Yes, I know. She was so excited. She was like, oh, you have to talk to Ruthie. She's so interesting.
The business is interesting. So
it is interesting. Yeah. She definitely tells me something. Like, she'll be like, oh, we got this thing in. And I know she loves jewelry. So she's always like, we got this ring in. It was so beautiful.
Yes, she does love the jewelry. Yes.
I know. Because we have a we have every once in a while we do like a big steak dinner together. And so we get wear like all of our big jewelry and go and have a nice steak.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, and get more Denise. That's our like every few months we do that.
Dress up for the cow. Sure.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really oh, well. Well, you should come check us out. It is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I want to come to an auction one time. I'm usually working on Saturdays, so that was the kind of the issue. But yeah, thank you again. That was so fascinating. Okay.
Well, thank you. You have a good evening.
You too. All right. Bye. Well, that's all for today. Thanks so much for listening to Making Good. You can find our podcast on all the platforms you find your favorite podcasts. You can also find a transcript of this episode and all of our episodes on our website, churchalley.store. If you loved this episode, please share it and let others know about the good work of Church Alley Cafe and Grocery. Thanks again for listening to Making Good. I hope you have a really good day. We'll see you next time.